Welcome to the IBDeditorials.com feature podcast. I'm Monica Showalter, an editorial writer for Investor's Business Daily. We're continuing our Testing Obama series, where we have experts discuss the major issues facing the Obama administration. Our topic today is Iran and what President Obama can and should do to prevent them from developing a nuclear weapon. Our guest is Michael Rubin, a resident scholar in foreign and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael's major area of research is the Middle East, with a special focus on Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Kurdish society. He's even lived in Iran. He also instructs senior U.S. Army and Marine officers deploying to Iraq and Kuwait on issues relating to regional state history and politics, as well as Shiism, the traditional religion of Iran, which has now become a theological basis for extremism. He also teaches strategy. Michael is the author of Eternal Iran, which explores how Iranian pride and a sense of victimization combine to make its politics contentious and potentially dangerous. Michael, thank you for joining us today. What would you say the status is of the nuclear program with Iran right now?
Well, it depends on which aspects you look at. The issue which troubles us most is the Iranian enrichment program. Iran has around 3,000 to 6,000 centrifuges spinning. Every time the International Atomic Energy Agency inspects, we find out that the Iranians have actually made more progress than we expected them to. At the same time, there's talk that the Bushehr nuclear reactor will be operational this year, and the Iranians have put out tenders for 5 additional nuclear reactors. Now, the danger here is not necessarily the public program, but concern that the public program could serve as cover for a more covert program. And when it comes to nuclear enrichment, nuclear power stations run on, I forget the exact figure, but it's somewhere around 4.7% low-enriched uranium. Now, enriching uranium from its natural state to 4.7% takes about the same amount of time as enriching it from 4.7% to bomb-grade material, which is around 96%.
I see. They're definitely advancing their capacity for enriching uranium, and it should be operational for power purposes this year.
Exactly, and on top of this, with the recent satellite launch, we've seen a great deal of progress with regard to intercontinental ballistic missile technology, and you combine the two of these and it becomes a source for worry. I always find it ironic when the Iranians demonstrate some new technological breakthrough, for example, the satellite launch, and someone will say, well, they haven't really perfected the technology yet. I'd argue that the time to act is before they perfect the technology rather than what we're facing down in Iran and Islamic Republic with nuclear weapons capability.
Exactly. You did write a recent editorial talking about the idea that we can talk to Iran, and that's considered a new approach. But you've exposed much of the history, pointing out that we've been continuously talking to Iran ever since the 1979 revolution. What do you think talking gains us?
Well, the proponents of talking will say that it enables us to understand exactly where the Iranians are coming from, and perhaps to then be able to exploit issues of mutual interest. Today, oftentimes people talk about this in context of Iraq or Afghanistan. The problem with this is that so long as we're talking, it's not so much the talk, it's how the talk is done and who we're talking with. Now, let's take one major issue today that people discuss. It's whether we should sit down and talk with Iran without preconditions. And knee-jerk reaction of a lot of people is yes, let's just see where they're going. But when we're talking about without preconditions, what we're actually talking about is acquiescing to an Iranian demand that we allow them to continue enriching uranium in contravention of 3 unanimous or near-unanimous United Nations Security Council resolutions. So by agreeing to sit down with them, despite this, what we're actually saying is that President Obama, for example, would agree to unilaterally put aside 3 UN resolutions, and at the same time, we then precondition the outcome of talks. We've already signaled that we're willing to see an Iran that continues to enrich. The other problem with enrichment, of course, is momentum. Who says that our opponent is sincere in any diplomatic negotiations? With regard to Iran, I mean, they can sit down and talk with us, and dialogue always changes the intelligence flow in the interagency process, the willingness to just go the extra mile. And Iran, meanwhile, could be running down the clock. Indeed, it's ironic that last June, President Khatami, former President Khatami's movement, a guy named Abdullah Ramazanzadeh, said this was exactly the strategy which the Iranians had pursued during the reformist era. And lastly, when we just look back at the reformist era, the so-called Dialogue of Civilizations, and we compare that to the timeline established by the National Intelligence Estimate, for example, we find out that when Muhammad Khatami and the reformers were talking about dialogue and civilizational approach and track to negotiations, what they were doing was working not only on a covert enrichment program, but also a nuclear warhead design.
Very interesting. Do you have any ideas on what the best way to deal with Iran is?
Well, there's nothing wrong with dialogue, and dialogue should always be the strategy of first resort. The question is, how do you approach dialogue? What Jimmy Carter did was try to reach out to almost any Iranian he could, because in the words of Cyrus Vance, we didn't have that many partners. Cyrus Vance, Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State,
yeah.
We didn't have that many partners out there, and so we had to take what we could. And what we found in that situation is every Iranian partner, in order to bolster his own credentials, would add demands, and we'd come off worse than when we started. Now, with regard to the present day, the issue is how do we raise the cost to Iran of defying diplomacy and defying international commitments? There's a lot of talk about targeted sanctions. There's a problem with targeted sanctions. First of all, if they don't affect ordinary Iranian people, then we can't expect a groundswell of resistance among the Iranian people to their government to develop. The whole point is to try to make Iranian people dissatisfied with their government and raise some pressure there. There's also the issue of more, again, with sanctions, there's talk of making sanctions sporadic. If Iran doesn't do something by a set period of time or add another sanction, and this has been a pattern to date, and it's been a pattern that's failed, I'd argue that the way to have leverage is to impose a whole broad swath of sanctions right away, and then we can tell Iran, if you do this, we will lift this sanction and we'll relieve some of the pressure. But so much depends upon how the pressure is levied. And then there's the whole issue of Russia and China. Now, there's two types of sanctions which we can talk about in this context, multilateral sanctions and unilateral sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with multilateral sanctions, I'm not so sure that it's possible, and we have to face the fact that if we can't get Russia and China on board, then multilateral sanctions simply aren't going to work. It's not fair to tell the Europeans, for example, to sacrifice $15 billion worth of business in Iran, if China simply moves in and takes over $15 billion worth of business, and that's the situation we've been on. In which case, if we can't bring China and Russia on board, we've got to either make a decision to let Iran go nuclear, which I think would be a travesty strategically for the United States, or to consider other options which are more coercive, although not necessarily military. Now, the other issue which we have at our disposal is unilateral sanctions, which actually can be quite effective. Under terms of the U.S. Patriot Act, for example, specifically Section 311, the president can designate Iranian banks, including Iran's central bank, as guilty of deceptive financial practices. In effect, what this would do is remove Iranian banks from the international financial stage. Neither Moscow nor Beijing, even if they wanted to politically support Iran, could afford to do business with an Iranian bank and, at the same time, any European banks or American banks and so forth, because they would become liable for any deception which the Iranians did. Now, this is the strategy we've used with regard to North Korea and used, to some extent, effectively. It's ironic that the Europeans are actually telling us we've used this power, the Section 311 power, 7 times, never against Iran, and the fact that we haven't used it against Iran, the Europeans say, demonstrates that we are not serious about taking on Iran. I mean, there's nothing more infuriating than to have the French or the British tell us that we're not being hardline enough. When we fall into the left of those two countries, we know that we're in trouble.
That's very interesting. Why do you think the U.S. has been hesitant to do that?
Well, when we talked to people at the Treasury Department, and we had fleshed this out, Senator Coates and Senator Robb had done through the Bipartisan Policy Center a bipartisan study group on Iran, and they interviewed people in the Treasury Department and so forth. And what they found, the Treasury Department people said that under Bush, and we're talking mid-level people now, they thought that Iran was such a hot-button political issue that if they imposed this power, if they encouraged unilateral sanctions and designation, whether or not the president did, the Treasury Department can do so at a lower level to some extent, that they may be seen as just acting for politics. Now, this is a real problem we face in any diplomatic issue when people think, well, how is this going to be seen by the press, as opposed to how should we judge the situation on its merits? Now, what this basically means is some real leadership at the Treasury Department, and with a new president saying, no, this isn't political, but the problem is, with the financial crisis and so forth, their attention is elsewhere, and they haven't exactly gotten their foreign policy team either all appointed or be working together.
But at the same time, wouldn't some sharp leadership from Europe, warning the U.S. to start doing this, wouldn't that be kind of helpful? I'm kind of baffled that Europe, which is the most under threat from Iran's nuclear program, has been such an ineffective player. I don't see them jumping up and down and hollering about this.
Part of this is the nature of the European Union. Uh-huh. Actually, before, when I was a bit snide towards France and Britain, putting French politicians aside, the French take Iran very, very seriously, especially the security services, because soon after the Islamic Revolution, in the years following it, Iranian agents assassinated, I believe it was 11 or 12 dissidents on French soil, and that's something that the French security services never forgot. This is after France had done its best to engage Ayatollah Khomeini, even flying him back to Tehran on an Air France flight.
And then
not only did they get bitten in this way, but they had their own marine barracks blown up in Beirut along with ours back in 1983. Now, the problem, though, has to do more with the broader European Union. We have this thing called the EU3, which is Germany, France, and Britain taking the lead on negotiations with Iran, and all three of those states are very, very frustrated. The Germans, of course, because of the amount of loan guarantees they have to their own businesses working in Iran, are a little bit more reticent to do anything, but even the Germans are quite frustrated. And after another German election, they may be in a better position to take action against Iran. The problem here then becomes states like Italy, Austria, Sweden, and Finland, who say, why should we follow your dictates? And Iran is masterful, especially when you have a unit like the European Union basically trying to peel one or two states off to break consensus. They've done it at the United Nations. They've done it with the European Union. Long and short of it is we see continued Iranian progress, and we also see a tendency for the Europeans, of course, to put commercial interests first. Between 2000 and 2005, the height of dialogue of civilizations, European Union trade with Iran almost tripled. During the same period in time, Iran was investing about 70% of its hard currency windfall into its nuclear and military programs.
Incredible. Thank you for such an interesting rundown on some of these important factors on that. How do you think the dynamic of the Middle East will change if Iran does get the bomb? All of this is pointing to this kind of inertia from the great powers or the fact that they've been roadblocked in various ways. We have seen a bit of an arms race among the Persian Gulf states. But how do you think that the ultimate dynamic is going to be? I'm thinking of even Singapore expressed worry that if Iran gets a bomb, it will travel.
Well, it's a real concern. There's a proliferation concern first and foremost. If Iran gets the bomb, and we're not just talking about the bomb, we're talking about the capability to build the bomb.
Yep.
They could be 1 or 2 weeks away and stop, and it wouldn't make effectively that much difference. Then you're going to have Saudi Arabia and Egypt insisting on building the bomb. If Egypt insists on building the bomb in Saudi Arabia, Turkey's going to want to do the same, and you can basically kiss goodbye to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we're not just talking about proliferation from Iran, for example, to proxies. We're also talking about proliferation across the Middle East. That's number one, and Southern Europe. That's number one. The second issue has to do with the issue of prestige. Just 2 days ago, President Ahmadinejad talked about how Barack Obama's offer to Iran really sealed the idea that Iran is now a superpower on par with the United States. Now, when Iran feels itself so self-confident, what you're going to see is two things. Number one, they can lash out using conventional means, not nuclear means, feeling themselves shielded behind their own nuclear deterrent. But when we look at the rest of our allies in the region, they're going to feel that they are going to have to make accommodations with Iran, whether they like them or not. And this is usually this is a constant theme of Iranian psychological operations and diplomacy. They will go and they will do demarches saying, you may like the Americans better, but we will always be your neighbors. So we're going to see countries like Bahrain, which we depend on for our main, the Fifth Fleet's headquarters in the Persian Gulf, suddenly say, no, we have to be careful because we have to run everything by Iran. We're even going to see countries like Egypt do the same thing. And remember, a lot of these countries are also running scared because after the Hezbollah-Israel conflict, for example, Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Iran's chief proxy in the region, became consistently voted, even in Sunni countries, to be the most popular political figure. A lot of these states that we rely on as allies are running scared. I mean, the biggest misconception we have is the idea that we're just talking about Iran and this problem can be compartmentalized. In reality, Singapore is right. We're talking about a far greater problem.
Exactly. What cards do you think the Obama administration does have? They have said we will focus on diplomacy, but we know that, you know, the U.S. is tired of having fought two wars, and we know that the U.S. general direction is domestic focused. Is there anything he can do any cards he has that could make a difference in the field of diplomacy or anything else?
Yes. First of all, I'm afraid that President Obama doesn't understand this because he doesn't have a background in the military and he has been relatively sheltered his whole life. But when we're talking about strategy, there's a natural inclination among academics to want to sequence strategy. First you have diplomacy, then you have economic sanctions, then you have a military strategy. What's actually very much needed, and what's a lesson that almost every administration has learned the hard way, is you have to do all these strategies, what the military talks about as the dime model, the diplomatic, informational, military, and economic strategies in conjunction with one another, and then they actually augment each other's power. For example, we already talked about how economic sanctions can be used to leverage diplomacy. Back during the 1970 Black September hostage crisis, when Palestinian terrorists had hijacked three airliners and flown them to Jordan, and also in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge had seized the SS Mayaguez, both the Nixon and Ford administrations respectively quietly deployed forces to augment leverage. They didn't make any public statements or any public bluster, but both the Palestinians and the Khmer Rouge knew that the U.S. had redeployed its forces, and that encouraged them to come to a diplomatic settlement quicker. Now, what's interesting, looking at the history, for example, of the hostage crisis in Iran, is the hostages were seized on November 4, 1979. On November 6, 1979, someone from the National Security Council, a lot of former officials at the time say it was Gary Sick, who's now a professor at Columbia, had leaked to the newspapers that the United States would not, under any circumstances, consider military action, that they wanted to resolve this crisis through diplomacy. And in subsequent interviews with hostage takers, after the crisis had resolved in the first day of Ronald Reagan's administration, what the Iranian hostage takers said is they were planning to leave the embassy because they didn't want to be killed. Mm-hmm. However, once that word leaked out that we wouldn't consider military action, then what happened was that convinced them that they had more leverage than they realized, and they continued the crisis for 444 days. Now, if I could just say one more thing, when it comes to military strategy, oftentimes there's this wrong conception in people's minds that military strategy, for example, equals bombing. I happen to think that bombing would be a bad idea against Iran, and I can explain that in a second. But what's important to realize is that military strategy is also a strategy of both containment and deterrence are military strategies. And unfortunately, it seems that all too often in the United States, people talk about containment, for example, in terms of a rhetorical strategy, not realizing that containment means, I mean, deployments of forces, military shipments to allies in the region, and so forth. It takes years of preparation.
Mm-hmm. And that's really intriguing. You said bombing Iran would be a bad idea, because often that's presented as, you know, either we do nothing or we bomb, and these are false choices. Tell me why bombing would be a bad idea.
Well, let me put it this way. Iran developing a nuclear weapons capability would be like dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Bombing Iran would be like dying of a heart attack. And then the question becomes, what sort of preventative medicine are we willing to take before we get there? I certainly believe that the worst, the absolute worst possible scenario would be Iran developing nuclear weapons. The reason you don't want to bomb is a couple issues.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, bombing can certainly disrupt Iran's nuclear program. It can't end it. It can disrupt it. It can delay it.
Uh-huh.
The question then becomes for policymakers, what strategy do you have to take advantage of the 2 or 3 years you bought through disrupting Iran's program? If policymakers simply can't come around to a conception, for example, that the only way to solve this crisis once and for all is regime change in some way, then what we're doing is using the military to kick the can down the road because politicians don't have the courage to actually make hard decisions. And to me, that's an abuse of the military. Now, if there was bombing, a couple things would happen. Iranians are fiercely nationalistic, and they would rally around the flag. We'd lose the hearts and minds of ordinary Iranians, even those, the vast majority of whom, are opposed to the concept of clerical rule. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is, in the Iranian government's rhetoric, the reason they need nuclear capabilities to defend themselves. What we would be doing in one fell swoop is justifying all their rhetoric. Given all the costs incumbent in terms of blood and treasure and so forth, the question then becomes, are there better options? And I'd say the best option, therefore, is to try to strangle Iran diplomatically and economically before they get this far. Unfortunately, after many, many years of dithering around on this question, I'm afraid that we're coming down to decision time. Iran's going to force the decision.
Thank you, Michael. I'm just, like, awed at all of your information.
It's always a joy. I mean, I used to live in Iran. My PhD is in Iranian history. I love the country. I love the culture. And it's always just a pleasure. The problem with talking about Iran is I never want to stop.
Yeah, it's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back soon with another installment in our Testing Obama series. In the meantime, be sure to visit IBDeditorials.com to read the latest commentary and the political cartoons of Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Ramirez. Thanks for listening.